This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is Maisie Williams as Iris Stark.
Sif Turner as Sansa Stark.
Isaac Hempstead Wright as Bronn Stark.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 12, recorded Wednesday, March 14th, 2012. I am Joel Duggan of StarCostOnline.com. To my right is Mr. Peyton Francis of CardboardTreehouse.com. Peyton, how are you doing this evening?
Shalom. It's all good, man.
Awesome. And Chad is not able to make it again this week. He had to work late. But in his stead, we have Mr. Matt Forkum from RobotBeach.com. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well, sir. Going well. And I guess before we get into too much here, I wanted to give you a chance to tell the fine listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and all that fine stuff.
Sure. I do a little webcomic occasionally. It's been about a one-day a week in recent months. It's normally about 3 days a week. I'm trying to get back up to that again. But you can find that at robotbeach.com. I also do a geeky podcast, much like this one, with my good friend Adam Huber of bugcomic.com. And that podcast is called The Geeks of Steel, and you can find that at geeksofsteel.com.
Nice. And you guys have links to that on your respective blogs as well, too, don't you?
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Cool. And for anybody wondering, I actually met Matt when we were co-hosting Comics Coast to Coast with Brian Dunaway. I'm still on the show, but Matt had to bow out while his life got busy. So obviously you're welcome back anytime, Matt, but that's how we ended up crossing paths. And once you know a podcaster, you tend to guest on other shows. So I thought it would be fun to have Matt on to fill in for Chad this week. If you happen to be new, go ahead.
I was just saying, it's great to be here.
Good. I'm glad to have you. And actually it's going to be a kind of a fun show lined up because all three of us saw a recent movie that's out in theaters, and all three of us happen to be comic artists and cartoonists, so it should be an interesting take on all that stuff to come. If you happen to be new to the Citadel Cafe, this is where myself and my two buddies here, usually Chad, but like we said, Matt is filling in, come to hang out and talk about the sci-fi and fantasy entertainment that we're into. We're not myopic. We will venture into other territories like music and books and websites and other things, not always sci-fi, but usually close. Just kind of a nice little pigeonhole for the show to fit into off the get-go. And I guess before we get into the main topics this week, I wanted to just kind of mention that I recently discovered that a friend of mine, Jules Faulkner, is going to be joining me at HalCon. And she announced it on Twitter. Yeah, Peyton, you know her. You know Jules.
Yeah,
from Promises, mm-hmm. which is at promisescomic.com, does a fantastic job, and she is actually going to be at the author's table next to me.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm excited to talk about that. But in that process, she announced that she was going to be on at HalCon on Twitter, and so I clicked the link and went to the guest list. Well, doesn't Jonathan Rhys-Davies appear as one of the celebrity guests at HalCon 2012? Mm-hmm. And along with a slew of other actors and stuff that are pretty big names in sci-fi. So I'm really stoked to see everybody. Because, of course, I mean, I remember, Jonathan Rhys-Davies, of course, is Gimli from Lord of the Rings and Indiana Jones fame. I can't remember his character from Indiana Jones, but it's close.
Yes, it reminds me of my grandfather.
Does he really?
Very much so, yeah. Eugene, one that Ewan's named after.
So. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. And the other guest is, he played Odo on Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. It's René Auberjonois, I think. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I'm probably butchering it. But anyway, I know I have René pronounced correctly.
It's funny, because I always remember him not from Deep Space Nine, but from Benson.
Oh, that's right.
Way, way, way back in the day.
And there's musical guests. Paul and Storm are going to be there too. And I've seen those guys on podcasts as well. They're pretty funny. So I'm stoked. I think HellCon is shaping up to be a decent con. So
it, yeah, well, it's a bigger venue. It is a bigger venue this year, as well as an extra day.
So. Bigger venue. Well, maybe the same venue or more of the same venue. That might be the case. But yeah, they're certainly doing an extra day, which is cool. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah. So what's new with you, dude? Anything shaking?
Just work. It's starting to ramp up around here. So just trying to schedule out what the spring is going to look like and all that fun stuff. And the neighbors, there's going to be some changes around here this summer as well. So while I'm trying to do more work in my home office, one of the neighbors here has a really big piece of land, and he's in his mid to late 80s, and he's now living with his son, and the kids just sold the land. So now what was once a nice little quiet spot with an elderly gentleman is going to be construction all summer as they're building 3, maybe 4 duplexes.
Oh, wow.
So we have a nice wooded lot around here with all these probably 50-year-old oak trees and beautiful shade in the summer, really cool and quiet up here, and that's all going to be torn up for bulldozers. And
oh, man. How many of those big trees are actually on your property?
There's a couple on our property, maybe. Well, I see one or two, but the rest of them are all his. He's probably got about these 10 trees over there that are between 3 to 6 feet in diameter. Anyway,
wow.
So they are. Yeah, it's nice because when the daytime sun, morning and midday sun's up, our deck has completely shaded from all the trees.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all going to be gone. So
That's too bad.
Anyway, progress. You know, when these houses were built here, I guess the neighbors didn't want them because they blocked their view. So anyway,
yeah.
You know, it all comes around.
Time marches on. Time marches
on. How about you, Matt? What's new with you?
Oh, geez. not a lot. Just trying to keep ahead of the ball. I am kind of excited. I've got an opportunity to go to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago tomorrow and shoot a new museum exhibit that's opening. And it's a Mythbusters-themed exhibit.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and the Mythbusters themselves, Adam and Jamie, are going to be there.
Nice.
And hopefully we'll be able to get some interviews with them, and we're going to eventually put this together into a video for the museum themselves to use in promotional campaigns and that kind of thing. But it's going to be exciting just to go. I love museum exhibits, especially like really geeky, science-y museum exhibits that use like a lot of like kind of cool, creative ways of, you know, explaining science to kids and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's from the sounds of it, it seems like that this is what this is going to be. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to your video.
Yeah,
that sounds like a really cool opportunity. And those guys seem really down to earth, you know?
They're very approachable. From
This kind of thing that doesn't happen every day in my, in my daytime work, but when these kind of opportunities come along, it makes me happy that I do the job that I do. So,
what is your day job?
Oh, well, my official title is motion graphics artist.
Okay.
So, like, I generally like to pretend that, like, that involves me doing, like, a lot of fun animation. But it could be anything from shooting videos of museum exhibits to, I think last week I put together a PowerPoint, a sort of a template, a graphics template for a PowerPoint for a client. Okay. So it's basically whatever they need me to do. I know quite a few programs and I do quite a bit of work. Recently I got an opportunity to do some animations for an Intel booth they're going to have at a technology convention in Barcelona, Spain. So that was fun to put together all the animations of that, having smartphones kind of flying around the screen and all sorts of crazy things. Just a little bit of everything, you know.
Oh, nice. No, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Well, very similar to what Peyton does. I mean, he does a lot of motion graphics and illustrated. What are they called? Illustrated.
I guess they call them infographics and stuff, but same sort of thing. Just, you know, corporate sales and training videos, stuff like that.
Yeah, so, kind of instructional things like how to use a site or how to do a thing or how to...
Yeah, you know, try to explain IT distribution systems in a palatable way, and it's, you know, kind of dry stuff, but anyway.
Well, I mean, I think it's dry coming in one end of the machine, but I think it has a lot of life when it comes out the other end.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you're sticking with what the client wants for a script, so I should be, you know, 30 seconds to a minute ends up being like almost 4.5 minutes, and you're like,
we should talk flying because I've got stories. I'm sure you
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, when a client signs off on every step, and then when they see one stage and like, this is not what we asked for, I'm like, this is exactly what you asked for, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's amazing how little clients appreciate time. And when I say that, I mean like a 1 minute long video is quite long for somebody to sit through. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you've got to keep the ball rolling. You got to keep the topic hot and, you know, everything kind of fresh and awesome. Otherwise you're going to lose your audience. And
yeah.
Clients oftentimes, yeah, you're right. They have 4.5 minutes worth of stuff they want to talk about, but they really only have about a minute of attention span from their audience. So, you know, trying to talk them down into a reasonable time length can be.
Yeah. Cause everything from their point of view is important and, you know, rightfully so, but you know,
sure.
Does need to be pared down a little bit,
sure.
But yeah, the more I work with clients, the more I get a kick out of the website Clients from Hell.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't want it to be orange, but I want to be more of a red yellow. You know, well, okay.
Funny story for the website. So for those of you who don't know what Clients from Hell is, it's basically like a Tumblr site, right?
Yeah, pretty
where
much. And
people kind of just post like funny sayings that a client has said to them
yeah.
one time.
Yeah,
like, can you make our logo redder or something like, you know, I mean, yeah. just really kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. It's blurry. Well, I sent you a low res file. Well, you know, it's blurry. Yeah. Well, it's a low res file, right?
You know. Can you make it unblurry?
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so it's just a whole bunch of these things. And I thought this was hilarious. And so I sent the site to some other coworkers that I work with. And I accidentally included in my links of coworkers an email address that went out to a number of clients that we also work with. And so they got to the site along with my boss, who's on that same list. And my boss emails me back and says, I don't know what this has to do with our clients, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, no, I didn't mean to send it out to them. I meant to send it out. It's just, I'm sorry. Luckily, I did not get in trouble for it, but oh, man.
Oh, wow.
We were able to get rid of the email before anyone saw, I think, but oh. It was a little embarrassing, for sure.
Yeah, I did that a couple of years ago. I went to an animation festival, and there was Wayne Gilbert was there. He's an animation professional. He's been worked on Men in Black, on the Worms. Worked on the Ang Lee, Incredible Hulk stuff, and for years he taught at Sheridan College. And he was at his animation festival, and I met him and exchanged email address and stuff. And then one day I was just sending an email off to a buddy of mine. And I hit his address by mistake. I'm like, what's up, bitches? I'm like, oh, no. Like, I'm sorry about that. Anyway.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, I did that one time, too, where I CC'd one of my podcast co-hosts on a bunch of stuff that I was sending to a client because they both had the same name. Mm. And so they both received the same stuff, but I mean, it wasn't any big faux pas because Lara at the time, I mean, the industries don't really cross. She works for Dal and the other Lara is a designer, but to the client, it's like, you're working on like concept paintings for toys that don't exist yet. So by contract, I'm not supposed to share this stuff with anybody. Mm. And of course I CC'd somebody with, you know, yeah. artwork included, like, oh crap, my bad. So, well, I mean, it was just a gentle email from the client saying, actually, you know, you should probably CC the correct Lara on that document. Oh, darn. Sorry. My bad.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, before we move into the rest of the show, I want to say hello to the fine chat room that has come to join us for our live broadcast. We record every Wednesday night at about 7:30 Eastern, 8:30 local for us. What time is it there for you, Matt?
It is 6:45 right now.
Oh, okay. So you're just an hour the other way.
Yep.
All right, cool. So we've got many waves coming back from the chat. So much appreciated the attendance, guys. Always fun to see the regular folks in the chat room. So from here, we can dive right into our Game of Thrones conversation. This is the Winter is Coming countdown, and we are nearing the end. This is episode 8, the pointy end, as a matter of fact. The plot covers the aftermath of Eddard Stark's capture. While the Lannisters seek to capture his daughters, his son and heir, Robb raises an army in the north. Meanwhile, Daenerys witness to a Dothraki raid on a peaceful village and witnesses a Dothraki raid on a peaceful village, and Jon Snow faces a new threat at the wall. The episode title refers to the sword fighting lesson that Jon gave Arya before their farewell. Stick them with the pointy end. It's probably one of my favorite quotes from the whole series. The episode attracted 3.6 million viewers for the night, a series high. It was well received by critics who praised Martin's adaptation of his own work as well as the actors' performances. And I have to say that the actors are getting stronger, I feel, as the series goes on. It was dedicated to Ralph, I can't remember or can't figure out how to pronounce this guy's last name, Vicinanza, an executive producer who had died of natural causes. The episode garnered an Emmy nomination for costuming, but lost to The Bourgeois. I have not seen The Bourgeois, but I'm sure that that kind of period costume would also be very lavish and stuff.
Yeah, well, it was all around the, you know, Pope and all that, the Vatican, so.
Yes, and this is the thing about the, I mean, it brings up a really interesting point, I guess, about the costuming on Game of Thrones. I mean, there's no lack of detail. I mean, it has every bit the weight that I feel like The Lord of the Rings had in terms of the quality of the costuming and the set pieces and all that kind of stuff. But everything is just so dark and dirty and gritty that you don't really notice, you know? I mean, maybe when someone pulls out a really nice shiny sword or some of the more lavish knight's armor are showcased. But most of the time, it just kind of, you know, it's just people wearing cloaks and fur because it's cold outside and everybody's dressed in brown and black and you can't really see a whole lot.
Yeah, it does feel very utilitarian, and yeah, I mean, if you compare it to Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Rings is very much not over the top, but very lavish and very intricate, and there's lots of design and you know, I don't know if you want to say runes and little, you know, little motifs and stuff to everyone's costumes, whereas on Game of Thrones, that is a lot more, you know.
Yeah.
It almost blends into the background, if you will.
Part of that might have been, I think part of the stuff in The Lord of the Rings is also the series has been so well established that they wanted to help the characters inhabit the actors inhabit the characters' roles more by, you know, having all the undergarments and everything else that only they would know about, right? So
Well, and it, and it has such a more of a function than a fashion.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, in Game of Thrones.
I mean, if you can, people always compare Game of Thrones with Lord of the Rings, and I mean, the Lord of the Rings is definitely that, like, the high fantasy. You know, you've got elves and dragons and orcs, and you know, you got all these elements where at least. And I'm not too familiar. By the way, I don't know like about spoilers and stuff. I'm not too familiar with the Game of Thrones series beyond what's been on HBO so far. So
I'm in the same boat. So.
Okay, I haven't read any of the books or anything, and I'd rather not know anything about it. But Game of Thrones feels much more. Real, or I don't know if the real is the right word, but less fantasy, and so therefore a little pulled back, a little more. I don't know what the right word would be for that, but
a little more Marvel versus DC in the movie categories, you know. You know, you look at, you know, something like Iron Man versus, I don't know, Superman. You know, a little more believable.
Anyway. Yeah, it's just a little more. Yeah, a little cautious or held back or something.
Yeah, I think the thing with Game of Thrones is that a lot of the time when you're talking about magic, it's more kind of science and alchemy as opposed to like really like bolts of lightning and over the top kind of dramatic things that most people think of when they think of like swords and sorcery. It's more earthbound. In that way.
Yeah, well and everything along that lines is treated with a sort of like you know, there's a history to it. People believe that magic exists, people believe that dragons once existed and all this kind of stuff. But it's spoken of as in like the old days or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like
they're forgetting that winter's coming, so.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. This is a different time that people are living, you know, all that stuff is sort of, you know, pushed aside and
and a lot of talk of magic is usually spoken out of fear. Yeah. You know, like a lower class society or culture would look at something that they don't understand and think that it's witchcraft, when really all it is just that the maesters understand that if you harvest certain plants and you beat them down and, you know, mix them with water, then you've got the milk of the poppy, which is an opiate that's a painkiller. You know, like you just that kind of stuff would freak the crap out of the Dothraki, you know, like it's just kind of a disparity.
Well, you see when the guy smacks the witch and he's, you know, too many witches' words cloud your mind, sort of thing.
Exactly.
Right? It's true. Yeah.
So Matt, have you seen the full series?
I have, yes. Okay,
cool. So
I watched it when it was on. So okay. Yeah, and I didn't know how much spoiler territory we're going to be getting into here. Should we get into?
No, well, where it's old, we don't worry about any spoilers beyond the show. So if it happened in the show, it's all good. Chad has read ahead all five books. I've read the first two. So sometimes we have a little bit of a hard time, Chad and I, kind of reeling back to make sure we don't reveal too much. Chad especially, because, I mean, he knows about people that die and new characters that come in and all that kind of stuff. And I'm still dealing with the same core people. But we just figured that anybody listening to this has probably seen the show. Or if they've started watching with us, they probably weren't able to wait and they've probably watched ahead. We always kind of warn people that, you know, we don't really worry about spoiling the series, but we don't.
Well, it's on DVD, so they probably just watch the full set. So
yeah, well, not, and that, yeah, not to mention, geez, I want that too. On this on Blu-ray would be fantastic.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
yeah, really.
Especially the commentary and the kids singing.
Oh my god, that was funny last week. That was a good time.
I started watching this series. I was vaguely familiar with it only because I'm kind of into board games, and it's been pretty well known in the board game community for a while. There's been, you know, a couple of board games and some card games and that kind of thing that's been based around the whole Song of Ice and Fire and all that stuff. And so when they was coming on HBO, I was like, oh, I'll check it out. I ended up watching it and I'm like, this is brilliant. I want to start reading the books and get into, you know, get ahead of the TV show, you know, start reading the books. And then there was somebody gets killed in the series. And I was like, oh, I was not expecting that. And it suddenly made me want to actually experience the series first and then go back and read the books so that, because I loved, like, it was such a shocking thing. And I realized that, oh, I'm dealing with something new here. Like, this is a series that's willing to take risks and go places where, you know, a lot of other television series aren't really willing to go.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this. I'm going to hold off on the books until HBO is done with Game of Thrones, and then go back and start reading from the beginning that way. So that's sort of how I'm approaching all of this myself.
Right on. I can see the value of that too, and especially because the books do start to get a little bit long-winded, just like Tolkien gets long-winded with his stuff. Like, there's a lot of stuff that they've cut out for the TV series that, although important, you know, to George R. R. Martin and the story that he's telling, not important to the overall plot points. Like, it's like, you know, it's like cutting the 20 minutes out of a movie that don't need to be there. You're left with an hour and 45 that still tells a damn good story and you don't miss a beat. And that's what they've done with the TV series. I'm really glad that they're doing it as a TV series and not as a movie. Because can you imagine trying to fit this all down in like 2 hours or even two-hour movies? It wouldn't fly.
It would be terrible. There's too many characters. There's too many interwoven stories and arcs and stuff.
Juicy dialogue that would just be lost.
Oh, you know? great dialogue. The writing all around in this series, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah, I agree.
This series itself has been like one of my just favorite television experiences ever. I saw The Wire, and the first season of The Wire, I think, was like the best season of television ever, and I was sort of upset because I'm like, I'm never going to have another best season of television ever. And then, you know, in comes Game of Thrones, and I was totally blown away by this series. So,
yeah, I think that it reminds me of Battlestar Galactica early on, before it started to get a little bit drawn out.
There was
characters in that you would get attached to, and then and then they would die, and you'd be like, well, crap.
this
series, I mean, because the thing, you know, like when you're watching a dramatic series on TV, usually the six people that are in the early credits don't die, you know, because they're in the credits. Therefore, they're probably signed on for a season. They're a major, you know, major player. And Battlestar Galactica would do that. They would pick somebody that's like a major person and they would kill them. And it completely would blindside you. And I feel
I think as an actor, that would be really fun just to sign on for that purpose too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times, I don't remember what show it was. I feel like it might have been Battlestar Galactica, where I was watching an interview with one of the actors, and they were saying that we don't know. Like, we're not told who dies and who lives. We don't know who the Cylons are. Like, the actors are kept in the dark until they do the read through.
And they're like, I'm a Cylon? Shoot. Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, I, there, I mean, there's no, not a really big surprise, but I mean, Matt, you obviously know that there's dragons in Game of Thrones. I mean, they show up in the last episode. So, I mean, they're coming and they're coming back.
Yeah. And I'm excited for that too. I was always like, you know, whenever I would describe Game of Thrones to anyone, I'm like, well, it's like Lord of the Rings, but there's no like real fantasy. There's no dragons, which is cool. It's cool that there's no dragons, you know. But then secretly inside of me, I'm like, oh, I want dragons. And we're going to get them. So I'm excited for that for sure.
And the wolves are getting bigger too. I mentioned last week that I saw a clip online, or not a clip, sorry. It's a picture. It's a still of Grey Wind. Rob's wolf, now larger for season two. And I'm anticipating that being very, very cool, especially because, I mean, the technology exists now that they can do stuff that looks damn real in terms of CG, especially if it's a just a larger version of an existing animal. Like they can, they don't have to worry about inventing physiology and trying to figure out how something with like six legs walks or moves. They can actually just, you know, go with just making a wolf bigger. So I'm thinking that's going to be pretty good. And actually, this episode is one of the first times we've seen Grey Wind in action. And I mean, the whole thing, I guess, snowballs after Cersei imprisons Eddard Stark, and it basically calls Rob into action. So he brings all of his bannermen of the North in to basically get together and then go down to war to fight the Lannisters to try to get Ned freed. And there's two things that happen. One, there's this big banquet where everybody's, you know, he's trying to basically get everybody to pledge allegiance to him and make sure that everybody's on his side. But no one really wants to follow this 15-year-old kid down into war. I mean, he looks a lot older on the show, but in the books, he's 15. And he has this really fun moment where, you know, he's squaring off with one of the older guys that he feels that he should be leading and all this kind of stuff. And eventually the guy gets so pissed off that he draws on Rob, or at least at the table. And the wolf goes across the table and takes off the guy's two fingers before he can even blink, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of those great moments where you're just kind of looking forward to, like, man, I can't wait until this thing is taking people off horses. Yeah. You know, it's going to be really, really cool to see when he's action, you know, when he's in action.
I'm concerned that HBO is not going to have the money to do this. From what I understand, this series gets pretty awesome, and I'm concerned HBO won't have the money to put towards something like this. They kind of ran out of money on a couple of their other shows. Like I think Deadwood was one of them, where that show kind of ended early, and a lot of it had to do with just production costs. And from what I've been hearing, there's been some concern within kind of the Game of Thrones community that HBO will abandon this series at some point, won't be able to see it through to the end, or won't be able to tell it properly. Yeah. There's a pretty big battle, I guess, that happens later on in the television show that is never really shown. And I assume that has a lot to do with just production costs and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there was a part, I can't remember which episode, it's coming up, where Tyrion is going into battle. I think it's the next episode, actually, where Tyrion goes into battle with the Burned Men and Shaiga and the other people that have helped him get back to his home camp. And he basically gets knocked out, and then you wake up with Tyrion and the battle is over. And I mean, that is kind of a, you know, creative way of not having to show all of it, right?
Yeah.
But that's also the first season. And I think that this thing has gained enough steam that HBO can probably put some money behind it with the idea that they're going to have to, because there's bigger battles coming. Like these things that are happening now are basically just skirmishes in the North as, you know, the Winterfell and the Lannisters are clashing. I mean, it's nothing like the kind of battles that happen later when you really have, you know, a vie for the throne, like all the different things that get put into motion. You're seeing like the first cog of war in series one.
And if HBO does drop it, I'm sure, you know, AMC or someone else will pick it up, because AMC has Mad Men and Walking Dead and all that, and those do have a, you know, sort of a finite amount of time as well. So
say
5 years down the road, you know, they're looking for something to pick up, and this could come on the market. So who knows, right?
Yeah, but from what I've heard, even Walking Dead had to take a pay cut for their second season, which is why you're not seeing as many zombie effects and a lot of the big time scenes like you saw in the first season. Mm-hmm. So I could see that as being a concern, especially as the series goes on and people kind of start to drift away from Game of Thrones. That, you know, I mean, I'll be honest, the only reason I subscribe to HBO is because of Game of Thrones. And so they're getting my money, you know.
And they're also, I think just today I saw a trailer online for the Game of Thrones role playing game.
Like, oh, really?
Yeah, like you know, sort of
like a World of Warcraft thing.
Yeah, more of a Dragon Age, I guess they're going with.
Oh, okay.
And at the moment, there's two main characters, and they have different fighting styles and different abilities and that sort of thing. But you know, if people start buying into that, then revenues from that could probably be filtered back into the TV show, because gaming is, you know. And, you know, the TV show could, you know, funnel people towards the game and back to the book. So
that's a huge undertaking, though. Like, I mean, I wonder how long that RPG has been under development, because, like, things like Star Wars were under development for a really long time. And they're, like, the Old Republic, and they're setting new bars for online gameplay in terms of, like, having quests read to you and certain amount of voice acting and stuff in the MMO as opposed to, or the RPG, or if it's both. You know, as opposed to having to read quests and doing that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, Game of Thrones, I don't know if I'd really want to play a Game of Thrones MMO. I feel, or RPG. I feel like it just might be too, it's like too much canon. Like, there's just, it's too much of the same.
Well, I think that the game itself is set outside of Stark's sort of world.
Oh, okay.
Like it's within the realm, but I think, you know, it's, you're not one of the main characters, so it just spans on that universe. You know, Martin started these books, what, back in 94 or something?
A long time ago, yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure he's probably, you know, investing some stuff into this too.
Yeah. I mean, and you never know. I mean, he might be on board to write some of the story for the video games and stuff like that. Yeah. So,
well, I guess he's doing one of them. He just celebrated his first wedding anniversary to a woman he's been with for 30 years. So,
wow,
you know, I guess he's feeling a bit more secure.
I bet she is too.
Yeah, it's funny because he was saying that the only thing they haven't merged are their libraries. So, but
you know, all the books that they have.
Yeah,
but is she a writer as well?
I'm not quite sure what she does, but he was saying that he finds it really interesting now that he gets recognized at restaurants and he's out in public like a rock star, because that doesn't happen to writers at all.
Ever, yeah.
Yeah, he finds it very weird, right? So.
Yeah, that would
be one of the benefits of being a writer.
Yeah.
You never get recognized.
Yeah. Well, he's got a really interesting look too. Like, he's got a really long goatee and he's got really big, thick glasses. And
yeah.
I mean, you'd be kind of easy to spot him out at a Denny's having pancakes or something.
So, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Pete.
No, you go ahead, man.
Well, I was just going to say that. I mean, one of the things that he continues to do with his series is creep me out. Lysa, Catelyn's sister.
Yeah.
I can't stand that woman. And it's I don't know whether it's the fact that she doesn't blink or that she's just this creepy, kind of has a 7-year-old that still breastfeeds.
Oh my God.
She's one of those, it's a good job as a character, but she's just the kind of character that you want to shake, you know, like she's so headstrong and so delusional that she's just through what she thinks is the right thing to do that she is not wavering from. She's going to endanger everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, it drives me crazy. And there's no reasoning with her at all.
I think the breastfeeding thing is the only thing that freaks me out about her.
Oh,
that is creepy as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I had friends of mine who traveled in Europe, and they were saying that they were at a farm they were working at, and there's a woman there with her kid, and the kid was like 4 or 5, and walked up and just basically pulled up the mother's shirt and helped himself while the mother's talking. And I'm like, dude, if the kid can ask for it, they're too old for it. Anyway, but that's just my opinion. Anyway.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Too funny. So, Peyton, do you have any favorite quotes from this episode?
I love Tyrion. He has some of the best lines, I think. The bit about, you know, do you want, what do you want? Do you want gold? Women? Golden women, you know, it's just, you know, whatever, you know, I've got money, right? I like living. You know, he's just very matter of factly.
Yeah.
And the bit about how do you want to die, right? He's like, in my bed when I'm 86.
Yeah.
With a woman's lips and all this stuff. It's really cracked me up.
Yeah.
But then his buddy Bronn, you know, and then when he's introducing him to his father, this is Bronn, son of, and then Bronn picks up and says, oh, you wouldn't know him. It's
like, yeah,
you know, just the writing of this thing is just so well done. Anyway,
yeah, right. And it's not often that you get a lot of humor in this kind of fantasy too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
Yeah, and Peter Dinklage does a great job in this series. You got to imagine that, like, for him, that this is like a just like the dream job to have, where you get to have play this type of dramatic role that is also, you know, very, very funny. But I mean, there's just so much to it. Did he do well in the Emmys? I mean, I was watching the same, like, this guy's got to win something.
Yeah, he won.
He's just amazing. He won.
Yeah.
Okay, sweet. Yeah, I didn't pay any attention to the Emmys this year, so I had no clue. But I love his character so much.
When his father's saying, you know, your brother Jamie did this or whatever, and he said, well, I'm very different from my brother. He's much braver than I, but I'm better looking.
Yeah.
There's a really funny picture floating around of him as Wolverine, anyway. Someone did a really neat painting. It's like,
take you out of the knees. That's funny.
Yeah. I believe it.
Oh, man. I think my favorite quote from this particular episode is early on when the news of Eddard Stark's capture reaches Winterfell, and Robb puts out the command to muster the bannermen, and he starts to shake after he realizes what he's done. And Greyjoy says, "Are you afraid?" And Robb is like, I must be. You know, is that good?" And Greyjoy is like, "Yeah, it means you're not stupid." You know?
Yeah,
I think it has a. I mean, it's funny, but it's also, you know, it has that weight of, you know, what's coming, and you should definitely be afraid of what you're about to do, because there may be no coming back from this. Like, what once things are done, they can't be undone.
Yeah, it's like the stupid thing with the captain at the Night's Watch when Sam's like, "You smell that? There's no smell, right?" And then the captain's like, "You're not as stupid as you know."
You may be a coward, but you're not stupid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah,
that's right. Exactly. Matt, any favorite moments from this particular episode?
I mean, as far as moments go, just the fight between Drogo and his man, where his man challenged him. I love that. I love the ripping the tongue out through the neck. I thought that was just awesome. His character in particular, I thought, throughout the whole series, him and his wife both, my absolute favorite relationship, I think, in any television show. It starts off where you hate this man, right?
Yeah.
And you kind of also like don't really care about her. Like she's such like a withering flower at the beginning of the series that you kind of like, well, you know, she's in here because she's, you know, she's the hot one that's willing to bare her breasts in the TV show or whatever. You know what I mean? And as the series goes on, there's like this when she sort of learns how to use her ways to soften him up, and he becomes, you know, a little. You know, a little more, I don't know what the word is, human or whatever. He becomes more of a, by showing his emotions and his love for this woman, he becomes much more powerful of a leader for that reason. And she becomes much more powerful of a leader. I just love this relationship between these two. And sort of this episode, I think, is a really great a moment for her coming into her own as being the queen. She's a queen, correct? Or
yeah,
Khaleesi,
yeah,
yeah. I don't know what the title is, but her coming into her own as a character, and then him like really getting an opportunity to stand up for her in a way that I don't think has quite happened so far in the series. I mean, there's been a lot of sort of grumbling and talking about her behind her back, and he's, I'm sure, been aware of it, but had to put up with it up to this point where he gets to actually just rip that tongue out of that guy's neck. Yeah. And
you see you see his pride in her defiance as well, in her saying, you know, I'm the queen, back off, right? So
I'm really excited to see where her character goes from here on out, because she went from being like, you know, one of my least favorite characters to my
sorry, Matt, I'm gonna get you to repeat that. Skype cut you off just as you were about to say something really important. She's your what? Your
She went from at the very beginning, she went from being like one of my least favorite characters to my absolute favorite character in the series. I'm really excited to see, you know, where she goes from here. And I really like how they built this relationship between these two characters. It's really unconventional, and there's part of you that goes, you know, because it's a relationship that's almost built from rape to begin with, you know, which is really unconventional, and kind of, it makes you like, I don't know, like, this is, I don't like this, you know, but eventually sort of it turns around, and it feels real, but it also feels like, I don't know, it feels like it gives her a lot of power and gives a lot of sort of just realism to how the relationship kind of unfolds in this kind of crazy, you know, time and place in which they live.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And she has this balance of hardness and softness.
Mm.
And she was too soft at the beginning, and Carl Drogo is maybe too hard. Yeah. So she is this kind of equilibrium between the two.
But I think she's, especially where they are running into that peaceful village, and they're, you know, ransacking the place and taking prisoners and all that and slaves. And she shows some heart there, and that might come back and bite her in the ass, and we'll see how hard she gets after that, right?
So I think a lot of it has to do with her personal experience too.
Yeah.
I mean, these women are being raped and pillaged and stuff like that, so she might be just kind of standing up for them. And she also, I mean, I don't really see a lot of strong women in the Dothraki kind of people. It's all, I mean, at least in the show, it's all pretty portrayed as men. So she may be trying to get, you know, fight for a little bit more female rights and stuff like that within there. I mean, I could be speaking out of turn. I don't know whether that's something that Martin was trying to get across, but I certainly start to see it a little bit.
Yeah, I certainly feel that for sure. You know, it feels like a more, I don't know if the word primitive is the correct word, but it's certainly a society that values men over women. It seems that way anyway. And she kind of comes in there, shakes things up.
Yeah. I remember
teaches her king that this is not necessarily, you know, the best way to treat women. And
But I think though, like if that society in that time frame would did actually exist, that could be a fairly accurate portrayal of what could happen there. Right.
Oh yeah.
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 I think that, this part of the story in the first book, when I was reading it, from this point on, this is when I really started to be excited whenever the book would switch to follow Daenerys and Drogo, because of where it goes from here. Although the wound that he gets in the fight when he's defending her, it was much more dramatic in the book, or at least it felt like it was much more dramatic in the book.
Yeah. And
this, it feels like it was a little bit more self-inflicted, like he walks into the blade a little bit. And
really, it looks like just basically a bad scratch.
Yeah. Like, I mean, well, he's cut. I mean, he needs stitches. Yeah. I mean, they got that part right. But I mean, I really felt like he was struck in the book. I could be remembering that wrong, but because it's been a while, but it really did feel a little bit more dramatic. So, and that's one thing I think takes away from it as the rest of the series progresses. I'm sure we'll talk about it in the weeks to come, is that where that wound goes and how it takes his character, it feels like it has like a bit of a lackluster, you know. It doesn't feel like it has as much worth from where it came from, you know.
Yeah, I agree. As I was watching it the second time around, I'm like, yeah, they needed to make that deeper or bigger or something, because on a guy that size, that doesn't look like very much, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about this last week about how big he is when he was attacking I guess eyeing up this guy that had tried to assassinate Daenerys, and he had had him tied to a pole, and he was looking down at him, and Peyton was saying that he looked like a cat. And I can't remember whether I mentioned it on air or not, but I looked it up after. And the guy that plays him, Jason Momoa, is 6'4".
Okay.
Oh, really?
He's a big dude, because he's not skinny either. Like he's got a lot of bulk to him. So I mean, he's got to weigh like 220, 230 maybe. He's a sizable dude.
He played a Conan in the new Conan movie. You guys have seen that one?
I have seen it, and it is not very good.
Yeah. I kind of like that kind of story, so I gave it a pass, but it wasn't terribly great. But
no. I think it's kind of a victim of the writing. And I mean, I would have rather seen him in a brand new barbarian-esque movie. Like, why do we make Conan? Like, why not just make something new? You know, come up with something original, or find a book or a graphic novel that hasn't been, you know, adapted yet, and do something really cool with that. You know, I mean, I would have seen him in Battle Pug. I think that would have been hilarious.
Battle Pug. Thanks for the mental picture.
Have you not read that comic, Peyton?
I think I have seen it from time to time.
Oh, I think we talked to the guy on Comics Coast to Coast a while back, and it is hilarious, really really funny. I feel like the Night's Watch is really starting to pick up too. I mean, you've got the first appearance of the Night Walk or the White Walkers that come back after they bring them back to the what's it called there? The Night's Watch, not the Tower. What's their place called? The Keep? No.
The
The Wall? I don't know.
No, I know The Wall. Okay, well, they bring it back to The Wall, I guess, but they weren't that far away from it in the beginning. I thought there was a name for the thing, but it's escaping me right now. Minus 12 geek points for me. but yeah, I feel like the events that start to take place there really start to propel the story forward for John as well, because, you know, in saving the Commander Mormont from these, you know, zombies that are basically attacking him, he really secures his spot as, you know, right-hand man, because he's defying orders of being confined to quarters to save someone's life. He's not just blindly listening to orders, which I think is something that Mormont really respects. And unfortunately, something else that was played down in the TV show were the burns that John receives from grabbing the lantern and throwing it on the White Walker. In the book, it's actually a drapery. And I think the lantern breaks on the drapery. So the drapery gets soaked in oil and then gets lit on fire. And then the drapery and the oil gets wrapped around John's arm as he's struggling to defeat this thing while he's defending Mormont. And so his burns on that hand are like, you know, fingertip to halfway up his forearm. Like he completely gets all burned up and has to have quite a lot of medical attention in the book. So, and it becomes part of his character. It becomes something that they use to illustrate kind of like his struggle and his regain of strength and stuff like that. And I feel like he just kind of like grabs a hot lamp and throws it at the guy. It's really, really fast. Like it doesn't really do its justice. And I mean, maybe that's a budgetary thing or however it was supposed to go, but I feel like in the book it had a lot more weight to it. But when everybody is gathered around, all of the young men of the watch watching the White Walkers burn, and Sam is talking about the book that he read and, you know, all the things that he's learning now, I feel like the way that they're standing and the way that they're kind of buddy-buddy with each other and communicating, it really reminds me of Band of Brothers. You know, if you guys have seen that series, you know? And because, I mean, it has that sort of military-esque feel to it.
And they're not getting attached to the characters because they're going to get killed off. So
yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, I thought that was really, really well done. And I guess the only other... I feel like I've got a lot of complaints about this episode. I mean, I liked it. I mean, there's lots of really good things that happen. But the other thing that I feel like they failed to communicate was the passage of time. You know, like 1 minute...
Yeah, yeah.
1 minute Catelyn is at the Eyrie, and the next minute she's with Rob in the north. And 1 minute Tyrion is walking through the woods at the Eyrie, and the next he's up in the north again with the Lannisters, his encampment. I mean, granted, Tywin has moved north to contest Robb and fight for the river and all that kind of stuff. But it feels like, I mean, moving that kind of host, that amount of army men across, you know, the world would take months. And it takes like a commercial break, or what would have been a commercial break if it was on TV. And I don't know, I feel like they could have done a better job. You know, I mean, I don't want them to cut to like an Indiana Jones red line, you know, moving across the map sort of thing.
Well, do you feel like even if they added the subtitle, like, you know, 2 months later, you know, across the bottom of the screen, something like that would be helpful?
That would help. But I think that if they started doing that, they would have to do it an awful lot. And I think that would get kind of tedious, because there was a couple things, you know, we had mentioned earlier in the series when Chad was saying that the King's Road takes, you know, like 2 months or something to travel from the north to King's Landing sort of thing. And I feel like, I mean, maybe they're, it almost like you need a narration.
Yeah.
You know, like I'd almost, not all the time, but I'd almost want like a maester or some really old kind of guy that's has been witness to all of this, be able to say, you know, like, you know, and then Rob, you know, took all of the bannermen of the north and he moved slowly over several months to, you know, encampment here. And then there's the great battle of, you know, blah, this happened here. And that would at least kind of give people a sense. Cause I feel like, I don't know. I mean, Lord of the Rings were able to at least communicate that how long it took to walk and
stuff. But I think part of the problem is there's such a sense of urgency throughout this entire episode that you kind of feel like things are moving along really fast, even though it is taking several months to, you know, for things to happen. So that may be part of the problem there. As I watch the episode, it feels like, you know, just a matter of a couple of days, But there are messages moving back and forth and that kind of thing as well, and all that takes time to get, you know, get where it needs to go.
All right. Well, I don't think we have anything more to say about Game of Thrones.
I just have one little quick look. You don't have to edit it in. I just thought it was cool, the Dancing Master at the very beginning when he had the fight and he's got this the wooden sword.
Oh, right, and he's taking on the guys and he uses
the cape. He just grabs the guy and it's by back to the Incredibles. Why capes are a bad idea?
No capes.
I loved his character too. I was so sad to see him go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, and they don't actually show him die, do they? At least not in the TV series.
I would think, like, when the going got rough, he would just grab one of the other guy's swords and go to work, right?
Yeah, but, you would think, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Right on. Well, now we can move on to the rest of the episode with movies, TV, and video. And, I mean, I'm just going to quickly say that I watched a few sci-fi movies this week on Netflix. Some of the Star Trek movies are starting to filter into Canada, so I watched Star Trek First Contact and Star Trek Insurrection. And then I watched Apollo 13 because I basically ran out of good sci-fi that I haven't seen. So I watched an old movie, and some of the people that were joking around with me on Facebook said that it's not sci-fi, it's just sci for Apollo 13. But that's it. That's all I have to say. They're all good. I enjoy them all.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we have all seen is John Carter, which was released this past weekend. Peyton and I went to go see it last night. Matt, you said you saw it over the weekend?
Yes, yep.
Fantastic. All right, well, Matt, let's start with you. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun. It's that same sort of like classic kind of pulp adventure, sci-fi fantasy thing that I've always loved. And I don't know much about the book series or anything that has gone before, but the movie so the movie itself has been kind of my first experience with John Carter, and I had a great time. I went and saw it in 3D, IMAX 3D, $17 a ticket. Bought two of those.
Wow!
And I think I'm done with 3D from this point out. The 3D itself is great 3D. It's so good that you don't even really, notice it. And so why do I even need to pay for a ticket for 3D? You know what I mean? Because I think, at least for me personally, bad 3D is the stuff that's like really in your face, like, you know, like spears flying at your head and
Beowulf.
Yeah. And it's also like really, when they try to make the frame really deep and my eyes tend to cross when, I have a hard time sort of working that image out in my mind. And really fast paced 3D, lots of cutting, lots of things swooping around. I have a hard time with it. I don't know if that's just me personally, if other people experience that as well.
Yeah, we were talking about that last night. The strobing effect you get from the really fast action.
Yeah. You can't really focus on anything that's happening, so you just kind of you pick up the motion, but not necessarily the detail of the frame. Yeah. I would have, if I had my choice, I would have seen this in 2D. I took my sister; she wanted to see it in IMAX 3D, so we went and saw it in IMAX 3D. But I think I'm done with it. The directors who know how to use 3D well tend to, go for a much narrower, 3D image on the screen.
Yeah, the depth of field is narrower.
And they go for a much more subtle look. And at that, when you get to that point, it's like the wow factor of 3D is kind of removed. And so why even bother?
Yeah, I mean, I always opt to try to see movies in a regular theater if I can. If they're that good and I want to go see them again, well, then maybe I'll give 3D a shot. Because, then I don't feel like I'm, spending money to go see a movie twice in theater. I feel like I'll go to the first experience and enjoy it as a film. And then if I want to really have some fun with it, I'll maybe go see it in 3D. And that's what I did with Avatar. I saw Avatar in a regular theater. And then my sister and I went way after it released. It was probably still like 3 months or something like that. It was in theaters for a really long time. And we went to go see it in 3D. But the thing about Avatar was we saw it in a very large theater. And because it was so late in the release, we had our pick of seats. So we actually sat a little bit closer than you normally would for a regular movie. And I find the biggest problem with 3D is that you don't always get to control where you see it. I wanted to see John Carter in IMAX, but because of where I live and the most convenient theater for Peyton and I to go to was Dartmouth Crossing, we went to a smaller theater. And the one that was there, it wasn't even big for a regular theater. There was just the one center aisle. Like, there wasn't seats off to the right and the left. It was just the one center. And I mean, like, I could see the rims of my 3D glasses and I could see the edges of the screen. And we were sitting not close, but we were close enough.
Yeah, like two-thirds of the way back or something.
Yeah, so. I mean, so it was just like, well, I mean, what's the point? Because, and everything was breaking frame, so you've got people up against the edge of the frame of the shot. So, I mean, they're not going to be in 3D because they're being flattened by the edge of the frame. And there was very few opportunities to really exploit the 3D. And, I mean, I don't want arrows flying at my head, like you said. I did appreciate in John Carter some of the depth of field, like some of the close-up shots and some of the throne room shots really kind of felt like you're watching a stage play. Like it really started to feel quite real, which I thought was cool. And those are probably the shots where it's mostly actors and props and real set pieces. The 3D doesn't really do it for me when it's a CG person, when it's mixed in with regular people. But the other movie that I saw in 3D that I really liked on IMAX was How to Train Your Dragon. And that was incredible. There's something about animated movies in 3D that do actually work when they're done well. But they were taking careful precautions. You know, like the dragon would be flying around. I mean, Hiccup would be on, what's the Night Fury's name? Toothless. And the wingtips and the tail wouldn't be touching the edge of the frame. So you'd have this extraordinary experience of feeling like you're flying on the back of this dragon. Not only that, but you're in an IMAX theater where you can't see the edges of the screen and the sound is really big and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, well, Peyton, you and I had a really funny experience last night with the setup and the sound in the theater. Like they spent 5 minutes explaining the sound system before we started the show.
Yeah, it was really funny. Yeah, with kaleidoscopes projected on the screen, which is really hilarious.
Oh, yeah. It was really bad presentation. I felt like I was in a really cheap theater in a small town. It was not really cool at all. So, I mean, that's all the technical crap out of the way, all the 3D, you know, complaining that we're all probably going to do. So what did you feel was the strong point of the movie? Peyton, anything that struck you as really important?
I enjoy the film overall. A lot of things in the film are things that have been used in other films, again, because this was source material for people to use things for Star Wars and, you know, other films. So, you know, a lot of it sort of feels familiar. The moving city was an interesting idea, and I think they pulled it off pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a little bit, you know, Wild Wild West sort of thing with the giant spider the flying ships were, you know, sailing on light and all that fun stuff. There were a few spots of the film that could have been a little more condensed, like there's a section when the princess and John Carter are having a little conversation within this structure and, you know, sort of trying to build some sort of relationship there, and that could definitely have been condensed a little bit. And you know, but I think everything that happened, you know, you can see the logic behind it, you know, like going back to the white ape thing and in the stadium and, you know, in order to rally the troops and all that stuff. Although at the very end of the film, you don't really get a feeling of that they were actually needed to show up. I don't know.
That's how I felt too. I mean, I think there was a couple of sections of the movie that could have been cut out and they wouldn't have been they wouldn't have been a detriment to the overall plot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like this suffers from the same sort of thing we were talking about with the Game of Thrones episode, which is that the passing of time wasn't clear. And when John Carter goes back to Earth, the person that he was there with is long dead.
Yeah, dusty skeleton.
Yeah, and there's no indication as to how long he's been gone. Yeah. That's your first indication. And he hasn't really aged, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it feels kind of bizarre in that way. And the relationship that they're trying to build with John Carter and the princess, it fails to have any real meaning for you because it's like, wait a minute, how are they head over heels for each other? They just met.
I agree. Yeah. Everything from like the point where, is he the one that asks her to marry him or is it the other way around?
He asks her.
He does it the end.
He asks her.
Yeah.
Okay. Everything from like, from there on, it's my favorite part of the film, but it feels so rushed because there's so much to happen before that that feels inconsequential to everything that happens from that point on, that you wish that there was more time to build up to that ending, you know. And yeah, I completely agree. There's some subplots that were sort of woven throughout the film that they could have easily gotten rid of and replaced with more character building moments that would have made you feel like these two characters were actually in love, because I never really felt any real sense of actual love between these two characters, even though like
you get the sense of lust, but not necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, thinking back on it, you're like, well, I guess they did kiss, but I mean,
and they shared the look when they were, you know, saddling up the horses, sort of thing, and
that had happened. There, so much had happened before that and after that that you sort of kind of lose all that until the very end where he asks her to marry him. It's like, well, okay, I guess.
Yeah, I was too late once, it won't be again. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
he rushes off in the battle, and anyway.
Well, that was a great moment too. Yeah. I love that, you know, he's sort of single-handedly like killing hundreds of these aliens.
Yeah,
and they never really feel like they top that moment again later on in the movie. And it's like, why does he need all the rest of this army? All he needs is a couple of swords, and he's fine. He can take all these guys out.
Yeah, and that happened earlier on, like when he was first captured by, what are they called? The green people? I don't remember what
they're called. Thorn, is it?
Thorn, yeah. So when he was first captured, he's being manhandled by just one of them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But later on, he's kicking the crap out of an whole army. Like, that kind of stuff. I mean, it was cool for a bit, and I was kind of expecting him to be overrun. Yeah. You know, I mean, a heroic, you know, valiant effort, but, you know, ultimately futile in the end, and he just kept on going, and to the point where it just didn't look like it was any effort, and that's where it kind of lost me. That's where it kind of felt like he was Superman as opposed to just John Carter.
Yeah,
like it felt like it was a little bit too much.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed about the film is just from the production side of it, they had all of the Thorn actors, like Willem Dafoe and them, walking around on stilts, so their heads were actually 9 feet off the ground.
Mm.
Right, so they're all walking around and they're acting and emoting and everything, and they've got the, you know, the avatar motion capture face rigs stuck on their cameras and all that stuff on their face and all that jazz. And for the actual interactions between the Thorn and John Carter, there's not a whole lot of wide two shots, you know, where you really would need them to be walking around as actors on a still. It just seemed like an almost, like I can see in some shots it would be necessary. But if you're just filming, you know, a couple Thorn actors or motion capture or whatever you want to classify it as right now, you know, talking to each other, you don't need to have the guys walking around on 9 foot stilts, sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
It seemed a bit, it just seems weird.
Yeah. So. Do you guys feel like the overall acting in the movie to me wasn't all that good? I mean, the voice acting from Willem Dafoe was great. A couple of the other voice actors for the aliens and stuff were pretty cool. I really felt like all the British bad guy people, the red men, the Mars red men, they were all, I mean, they're all basically generic guys that you've seen in movies and TV shows like Rome or Gladiator or like insert kind of any kind of old classic British accent type actor here. And they all just don't have any real screen presence. Like they just,
I guess in Disney's bid to make this into an epic film, you know, they were looking for people who could perhaps fill those roles. But
I mean, and even the lead guy, I mean, again, I'm blanking on his name, but he isn't a very good actor either. I mean, I liked him in Friday Night Lights, but I don't like him, you know, in this at all. Because I feel like, you know, he can't yell, like he can't raise his voice. And he doesn't seem to have any kind of range. You know, he's not scared. He's angry some of the time or most of the time, but he doesn't like, I could be missing things. Maybe it's more subtle than I wanted it to be, but I feel like there should have been a little bit more of a smile when he looks at the princess
it was all a little too Twilight.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, he smirked, but that's about it. Right. Yeah, I don't know. The actress that played the princess, I thought she did well. And there was a couple of other actors. The guy that played Edgar Rice Burroughs, the nephew, I thought he did well.
And I like how they tied Burroughs' character into the story.
Well, that's what he does. Yeah. He puts himself in there as a character every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that too. I that, and as I said before, that that whole like back half of that film where, you know, he's sort of in, he's solving the sort of the riddle and going out to meet John Carter and all that stuff. I thought that was a lot of fun. And this is a whole series of books, correct?
Yes.
I mean, there's like three or four of them. So yeah. I'd be interested to see, you know, as the movies go on, like how his character continues to play a role in this whole overarching story.
And I'm actually interested to read the books, having seen the movie now. I've got a funny feeling that this is one of those cases where the books are probably going to be much better.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
You know, I mean, a lot of people complain that movies aren't as good, but I feel like this might have been, anybody that's a big fan of those books is probably a little bit pissed off right now, because I can't say that I disliked the movie. I found it entertaining. There were certainly some points where I was laughing. I thought, you know, the special effects were great. The, you know, the action was pretty good. Like we said before, I could have dealt without the 3D, but, you know, beyond that, maybe it's just that I'm getting kind of old and get off my lawn when it comes to this kind of entertainment as a creator. But I really feel like if you don't have the story wound up tight, and something that I really expect more from Andrew Stanton, you know, one of my favorite Pixar directors. I mean, the guy directed Finding Nemo, WALL-E, and co-directed Bug's Life. I mean, he's one of my favorite storytellers in that realm. And I was like, really, dude, you signed off on this? And I feel like it's one of those movies that might have gotten into the hands of some producers and too many spoons in the pot and kind of lost that control. Well, because,
you know, if you got a $350 million budget with marketing, and is including marketing, you know, you're not, it's not the director's vision.
No, well, exactly. that's probably the right thing. But, and he also, I mean, he's outside of his wheelhouse, you know, well, not his wheelhouse, but like before he was in Pixar, you know, and Pixar was not even part of Disney back when he was doing some of those movies. Then Disney bought Pixar and John Lasseter becomes the head of animation for Disney. So you're still dealing with the same people. Like it's just, it's still John Lasseter at the top, and it's, you know, the same crews within that. But then once you go outside of animation and you're into live action Disney, you're dealing with other people. And, you know, so, and it's not under, you know, John Lasseter's control and probably out of your control if you're Andrew Stanton. And I mean, having just watched that 20-minute TED talk that he gave about storytelling, which was very good, it gave me hope for this movie. And I feel like, I mean, for people that are into this kind of thing, I say, yeah, sure, go see it. But don't, like, if you don't go in with really high expectations, you know, I think Disney was trying to get another Pirates of the Caribbean on the go.
Who knows? You know, maybe it will catch on, right?
Well, I mean, Spider-Man 2 is way better than Spider-Man 1.
Yeah.
Maybe John Carter of Mars will be way better than John Carter. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I do like how they didn't, you know, Stanton wanted to have it so that it would be John Carter, and he earns the title John Carter of Mars for the next film. So
yes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring up Pirates of the Caribbean, because I was thinking the same thing, that this is, you know, Disney's attempt to bring some of that magic back. But if you remember the first Pirates of the Caribbean film, it was a pretty simple story. It didn't start getting convoluted and complex with too many characters and too much going on until film two. The first film was pretty straightforward, a small cast of characters, and everyone had very clear motivations and clear goals, and you know, the love story, the relationship kind of that builds throughout that felt more real for sure.
And I
just don't know if that's, you know, if this is the problem of trying to fit as much of the book as possible into the film so they don't, you know, upset the fans, or if they're trying to build, you know, other threads for later on in the series, although I don't know how that's possible. I do think that the film was well directed. I you know, if you separate out, I tend to take films that are what I think are, you know, shot well and directed well with poor scripts. I tend to like separate those things out, like, well, maybe the director just didn't have a whole lot of say when it came to script. And I think that maybe we see that here. This film has one of my favorite decapitations in it.
Yeah,
where John Carter takes on the—I don't know what the character's name is—but the one that sort of usurps the throne.
Yeah, the broken horn guy. Yeah.
Yeah, it has this really great moment where, you know, they sort of like pass each other in midair, and then John lands, and then the head lands. It was really well cut and I think well shot as well. So
yeah, and they didn't waste 10 minutes of a sword fight.
Yeah,
it's very much like, you know, I'm ready to step up. You need to get out of the way. Right.
Yeah. Well, and John Carter does feel like he's this larger than life character, You mentioned earlier that, you know, with the fight scene where he kind of becomes Superman. I like that kind of thing because I think that, for me, this type of pulp fantasy adventure story is about these larger-than-life characters, these sort of Paul Bunyans or these kind of characters that, you know, become larger than life because of sort of the storytelling of the whole thing, you know. Maybe maybe the real events didn't quite go down like that, but you know.
Well, you're watching it from the point of view of the myth. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and I like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
That's a really good point. Do you guys know whether John Carter of Mars was written before or after Superman was invented, was created?
Well, I have no idea. We could probably figure that out pretty quick.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking, like, while you guys are talking about that, like the man and the myth and all that kind of stuff, I'm thinking about, you know, like leaping tall buildings in a single bound, right? Because Superman didn't fly when he was first created. He was jumping. And John Carter, of course, can't fly, but he's jumping. And I'm curious as to whether Superman is based on John Carter or John Carter was...
1911, it was written.
Wow, well before Superman.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it has that very sort of golden age sci-fi feel to it. You know, the age where people actually thought that if you went to Mars, you might find a whole other society of people living there, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I feel like that's one of the things about the high concept of the movie, that they ask you to commit an awful lot to their suspension of disbelief at the very, very get-go. I mean, you've got these dragonfly ships, you've got sci-fi and lasers, but everybody's walking around half naked in armor. Like, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So you just kind of have to commit to this culture. And I found that hard to do. Maybe that's because I'm a product of Star Wars, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, where everything is very practical.
But like, we're also coming into the that particular world 100 years ago.
Oh yeah,
and that civilization only has two cities left and is on the verge of just disappearing. So, yeah.
I mean I like that kind of story to begin with. So I was all ready to buy into it. The one thing that I didn't care for was a lot of the design of the film. I didn't like the ships. I didn't really like the costuming. The costuming felt a little generic, and the ships felt a little over designed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I don't know. It was a lot of it was sort of clockworky in some ways, but you know.
I guess trying to tie in the Victorian era with a little bit of the futuristic stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. The only thing about the ships that was clear to me was that all the little scales and the wings were solar panels. That was the only thing that was communicated really clearly. And they shifted, and that's how the thing made its energy, and that it flew on probably like dispensed heat or something. But you're right. Like, it just, the design of it was taking away from the function of it, and it could have been executed a little bit finer or more economically.
Yeah, I mean, warships never really felt like warships. You know, it's just... It sort of had too light and too pretty of a feel. I don't know. I didn't really dig it.
Yeah, it reminded me of a lot of like the sci-fi fantasy art that I saw growing up in the 80s and stuff like that, where you would see like ray guns and crazy helmets, but then the girl would be in a veil and she'd be half naked, and then there'd be pillars and an altar behind her, but it's supposed to be sci-fi, and it's just like, I, you know, make up your mind, like either go sci-fi or fantasy, just the two of them together.
I guess but the source material for this, though, you know, if we are looking back at the time frame of 1912, you know, it's 1910, it is, you know, this is one of the first sci-fi books out there. You know, you got things like, you know, the Time Machine and stuff like that too, like a little later. But yeah, it's just, you know, they're taking a lot of Victorian aesthetics into the, you know, what it could do. So maybe they're basing the designs off descriptions from the book. I haven't read the book, so.
Yeah, and it's tough when you're entering into a movie and you're not familiar at all with the subject matter.
Yeah.
You know, or with the source material, excuse me.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got 100 years of sci-fi, you know, evolving, you know, so you move from this sort of thing all the way up to, you know, Flash Gordon and moving on like something like Blade Runner, and then pulling it back from how dirty Blade Runner was, right? I don't know.
Interesting. Right on. I mean, that's, I'm pretty much done with Mr. Yeah. Carter. Do you guys have anything you'd like to close with?
I just want to say one thing that I think is a huge missed opportunity. and it may come with from a lot of the art or maybe even the story itself, but I wish Mars was redder in this movie than it was. Yeah, it felt a little too Old West or deserty, and I felt like they could have taken more advantage of the fact that they were on a whole different planet. I realize that Mars in real life isn't as red as we think it is, but you know, it could have used a little more red.
Yeah. Yeah, the all the plant life also reminded me a little bit of the byproducts from the spaceships in War of the Worlds, the Tom Cruise version. You know, after they would, you know, spread out the fertilizer, you know, what that sort of the growth sort of looked like, some of the stuff from the film. So
Yeah. I mean, for me, the thing that was lacking the most, I guess, from the story was a clear villain.
It's true,
I think at the very end of the film, that sort of established, you know, who the bad guy really is. But
I mean, that has to be clear to you. You know, like, well, we brought it up in Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, like, you've got the hero, you've got the damsel in distress, you've got the wild card, and you've got the bad guy. Mm. You know, I mean, I know that is very simple for some people, but it really works.
Yeah. It works well, yeah.
You know, I mean, Avatar is a recycled plot. I mean, it's cowboys and Indians and any, you know, a million different ways that it can be told. But you have a hero, not necessarily a damsel in distress, but you've got certainly a love interest, you know, and you've got a bad guy, you know, and it's very clear from the beginning of the movie who the bad guy is, you know. And I think that this was lacking in that. Maybe
the shape-shifting didn't help us either.
No. Yeah. Like, it doesn't mean you need an icon. Like, you know, you need a Darth Vader. You need... you know, somebody that's going to be hated and be feared, and, you know, you can't be feared if you're not visible to anybody else.
I think I'm talking myself out of liking this film. I think I got to say, like, I do think it's worth seeing, you know, if you're looking for a film, I think that this is totally worth your money and totally worth your time.
Yeah. Great escapism for sure.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I want a dog just like the dog that he had.
Oh, who doesn't?
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of jumping, I'm taking a guy off a horse. That scene was pretty funny.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
The giant mouth flying at you at about, you know, 80 miles an hour.
Right? Slop.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, Peyton, what else have you been watching this week?
Well, my wife and I watched The Help earlier in the week, and it was a very enjoyable film.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah, I really liked it. I thought it had a lot of good elements of how they tied in with the, you know, the civil rights movement at the time and the area of the country that it was set in. And yeah, I thought I can see why it garnered so much praise, especially for the cast and how she won you know, the Golden Globes and Screen Actors Guild and all that fun stuff. And in the film, if you get a chance to see it, the terrible awful is terribly funny. It really it's a great moment. They touch on it at one point earlier in the film. And the woman who does it says, you know, I'm not going to talk anything more about that. And then later on in the film, she brings it up on her own, and it sort of sets it all in. But have you seen it, Matt? Or
yeah, I saw it with my wife, and I agree. I think it's a great film. It was up for an Oscar for Best Picture. I don't know that it's Best Picture, but it certainly is a lot of fun. And I think this is, if you're looking for something to watch with your wife and you can't get her to, you know, sit down and watch, you know, Cowboy Bebop or something that you like, you know, this is maybe something that you know, that she'll like. And I think anyone would like this film. It's funny. It's
there's peril, like there's real peril. Like, you're like, what is going to happen to these women, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's sort of all over the map as far as sort of emotions that it brings up in you. But it's a very, very well made film. Great acting, I think, all throughout the film. Very compelling. So I liked it a lot.
And it really does show things from both sides. And I get with her mother as well. You know, what happens with her. I guess house help or whatever you want to refer to, how that situation is all handled. You can totally see it from both sides, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't seen it, but it's on my Apple TV as rentable from iTunes, so I may look into that. If it comes into Netflix, I'll definitely check it out. But it looks like it might be something worth checking out. It's nice to take a break from all the typical kind of stuff that I watch.
Yeah.
Matt, what about you? What else have you been watching this week?
I saw a film. I'm only about halfway through it right now, but I started watching a documentary film called Being Elmo. And it is about the man who is the puppeteer behind Elmo from Sesame Street. And it is a fantastic documentary. I watched it with my wife, and we're only about halfway through, and we're kind of waiting for a night where we can get together and watch the second half of it. But, you know, I've always been in love with the Muppets. Like, it was one of those sort of, as an animator, I love the idea of, you know, bringing inanimate objects to life. And so, like, one of the things when I was trying to decide as a high school student what I want to do with the rest of my life, I was, you know, looking at puppeteering and this kind of thing, and I'm just like, you know, I don't think it's quite for me, but you hope that the people who pursue this life and get these jobs are good people, deserving of Sesame Street, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this guy's fantastic. He talks about he grew up as a poor black kid from Baltimore, like living in public housing, like absolutely as poor as poor can be. And turning on Sesame Street, seeing Sesame Street when it just came on, and you know, these were characters that he could identify with, and he fell in love with it immediately, and he began watching Sesame Street, and he said that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to do Sesame Street, and so he began watching Sesame Street, he'd sit very close to the TV and look at the puppets and try to decide like how they constructed these things out of the felt and the material that they made, and then he would try to make these things on his own, and as a high school student, he would make puppets and then set up a sheet across his clothesline in his side yard and invite all the neighborhood kids over and do puppet shows for them. And this eventually turned into him taking his puppets to children's hospitals and special needs programs and interacting with the kids there. And he eventually got a television show on Baltimore local TV. And you know, it sort of works through his life as he eventually gets to the point where he gets to meet Jim Henson and gets an opportunity to work on Sesame Street, the thing he'd been sort of, you know, pursuing his entire life. And it's a fantastic journey. And this is a guy that's so full of passion, and they've got amazing footage of him as a high schooler, like with these puppets and interacting with these kids. And you're like, where did they get this footage? It's like they had a documentarian following him around the camera his entire life. And, you know, as a creative person, and all of us here are creative people, and I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this is creative, you know, it just makes you want to try that much harder to you know, create whatever it is that you're creating. Because the passion that he brings to his work, like you know what that passion's like, you can feel that inside yourself, and it's absolutely inspirational and fantastic, and I can't wait to watch the second half.
Yeah, we watched it a while ago there, and it's definitely worth finishing up for sure. It's and also shows like the personal rewards as well as toll that, you know, being the character can take on him over time, you know?
You guys are the fifth and sixth people that have now recommended this, and I haven't seen it yet, but it's now on my to-do list.
Oh yeah. It's great. I love it.
All right. Well, that wraps up what we're watching. I guess we can move into a quick mention here in what we're reading. Peyton, you had something as well as Matt. I haven't started reading my book, but it's on my nightstand. And we mentioned earlier in the show Jules Faulkner and her comic Promises, Promises. Well, I bought her first book, which is from promisescomic.com. I think it's just called Book One. The title at the moment is escaping me, but I have not yet dove in. I read her comic when it comes out a few times a week, so I'm looking forward to it very much.
So you buy a comic book shop, or you buy it from her website?
No, I bought it from her website. And I bought the artist edition, so she did a sketch. It was very clever. She asked me my two favorite characters, and so I told her which ones I liked, and she drew them looking at a computer, and on the computer is a dating site, and then the profile on the dating site is Charlie from my comic.
Very cute.
Which I thought was very good. Yeah. No. Nice. Peyton, next time you hang out with me, remind me, and I'll show you the sketch. It's really quick.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I posted a photo on Twitter. I'm not sure if it's still bumming around, but I took a couple shots when it arrived because I was excited. So, so what are you reading, Peyton?
I go to the library getting, you know, kids books and stuff for my boy, and I saw they had a Batwoman there. And I'm not quite sure if it was from the relaunch of the entire DC universe a while ago, but it seemed to be in the same style, the redheaded sort of thing. And it's called Elegy, Deluxe Edition, and it's a really interesting take on her as a superhero, because she comes from a military background,
her father's in the military, and he's a colonel or something like that. And it goes back into her origins and that sort of thing. So she's not like, you know, super wealthy billionaire sort of thing. But she, yeah, shows her, you know, how she gets her toys and all that stuff. And she's not really affiliated with Batman. But one interesting thing is about her is, you know, she, at one point she's in the military, but she gets discharged for the entire, you know, don't ask, don't tell sort of thing about the being gay and that. So it's a really interesting book, and they bring in a her I guess what was going to be her nemesis, and it's sort of a Joker-esque sort of character named Alice, and she sees the entire world as being her being Alice from Alice in Wonderland. Everyone else is just a bit part in it for her to. Know, disposable extra sort of thing. So it's actually a pretty fun little read. I'm not quite sure how well the series is going to do ongoing, but and there's some weirdness there that I'm not quite familiar with from I guess an earlier story arc. This is a collection of you know so many issues, but yeah, it's I enjoy the artwork in it, and I thought it was a fun read. Again, local libraries have all kinds of great you know graphic novels and that sort of thing. So
right on.
Anyway, and how about you, Matt? What you been reading?
I've been in the middle of a trilogy of novels called the Eisenhorn Trilogy. It's based in the Warhammer 40K universe. Are you guys familiar with this at all?
I know what it is, but I haven't played any games.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a tabletop dice rolling miniatures game, and I'm not terribly familiar with the game itself. I'm not really even all that interested in the game, but. The novels are, you know, you see, you know, you go in the bookstore and you see these novels that are based on video games are kind of off in the corner and you're like, you know, you kind of shy away from it a little bit. I don't know where or why I started getting into it, but, I really like the idea of a sort of a fantasy, the fantasy genre as if it was told in a sci-fi universe. And that's what Warhammer 40K is essentially essentially that, where part of what I love about fantasy is this idea of a huge history. Like, you know, the armor you're wearing dates back centuries when this king wore this armor in battle against these people and won a great victory, you know, that has had consequences ever since then. And in science fiction, you don't necessarily get that because it's all like future technology and everything's kind of pushing forward in time. There's never really a great sense of history to things. But in the Warhammer universe, the idea is 40,000 years in the future, humans have been at war with each other or with aliens for so long that we've kind of lost the ability to create new technology. And the technology had gotten so good that it's sort of power armor and weapons and tanks and all this kind of thing kind of last for centuries. So you may be wearing armor that's 20,000 years old, that kind of thing. Or fighting on a specific planet for a factory that makes a type of material for a tank. And this material, nobody knows how to make this material anymore. You know, but 30,000 years ago, this factory was built to make this type of material. It's huge and it's a complex world, and it's a little difficult to get into, I will admit. But these books are written by a man named Dan Abnett, who is a fantastic author. I've read a lot of science fiction, a lot of novels over the years, and I've only read a few authors that can write as good as this guy. And I kind of wonder, like, what the heck is this guy doing writing Warhammer 40K novels? He should be doing his own thing, you know what I mean? And it's almost like he's in this genre and in this world that nobody else is going to be privy to because they're going to look at these Warhammer 40K novels and kind of, you know, turn their noses up to them. Amazing author. These books, the Eisenhorn Trilogy books, are really amazing in and of themselves. I'm loving it. If you are interested in the Warhammer 40K universe, it is so big and it's so so difficult to get into at first. I'd recommend you pick up a different book. It's called Let the Galaxy Burn. I haven't actually read this yet myself, but a lot of people say that this is the book to read if you want to get into Warhammer 40K. It's a series of short stories that kind of introduce the tropes of the universe and sort of the rules of how things play out. And it introduces everything to you in, I think, a way that's in small enough segments, I think you can decide quickly whether or not it's something you like or not. And so that's what I've been up to.
Nice. Cool. Very cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing some more reading as I hopefully get some more free time over the next little while, because I'm building quite a block of things that I'd like to check out. And, you know, with now John Carter and, I mean, even the Warhammer stuff, I've heard that World of Warcraft have really good novels as well. And I haven't had a chance to get into those. But I guess we can move on into what we've been listening to. And I have actually a quick pick myself. I found through, I think it was Google+, I found this link to a YouTube video. And it is a Spanish guitar solo by Albanez Astriez. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And then animated by James Edwards. And it is very, very simple graphic animation. It's not normally stuff that I'm very into. Because whenever I go to a film festival and there's like abstract animation, it always feels like noise on film, and it just kind of gives me a headache. But this really has some structure to it. It has some design, gives you something to look at. It's almost like watching an equalizer as you're listening to this music. Not only is it a fantastic solo on a Spanish guitar, which I'm usually a fan of, but it's also a very interesting visual display. So I'll throw that link in the chat room for everybody. And of course, it's in the show notes. When you have a minute, it's a fairly long song. It's about 6 minutes long, but I really enjoyed it, and it's worth checking out.
It reminds me of one of the old Norm McLaren animated shorts where he was showing the waveform on the side of an old piece of film.
Yes, it's sort of like that. Yeah. The dot and the line sort of business.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Peyton, what about you?
Speaking of dot and line, yeah, the director of that has a. A 14-minute and 10-second talk of Mr. Chuck Jones of Looney Tunes fame. And if you go to iTunes U, then the IT University via your iTunes app, or on if you have the phone or all that fun stuff, they have the Academy of Achievement. It's a section within iTunes U, and there's a talk there by Chuck Jones, and he goes into in detail in front of an auditorium about his experiences working as an animator over the years and his dealings with producers and the like. And it is really quite quite funny. Anyway, he goes in a bit of saying how Lena Schlesinger was quite stupid, and how great that was to have someone who just like, all right, boys, go do your thing. I'm off to the track, sort of thing, to watch his horse races and all that fun stuff. And I'm not quite sure if it was Schlesinger or another... Another producer came in and said, don't do any stories about bullfighting because, you know, there's nothing funny about bullfighting. And him and like Monty look at each other like, oh, my God, why haven't we done one yet? And they do a series about bullfighting. And they're hilarious.
That sounds like a challenge.
Challenge accepted.
Well, it's totally, you know, anyway, it's good stuff. I like his entire approach to filmmaking. Anyway, you know, they would do something like What's Opera Doc that would take, you know, 3 months or something. And then they would do, you know, the Roadrunner cartoons would take about 2 weeks apiece. So that way, you know, at the end of the year, they had their, you know, 6 weeks per production if you average it out. But they were able to do something like What's Opera Doc that had, you know, a ton of background changes and, you know, huge, you know, art direction that. And then you do these little chase sequences that you can knock out in 2 weeks. And, you know, the powers that be didn't care, you know, how long it took them to do, as long as they had, you know, a new film every 6 weeks, right? So
nice. Very cool.
Yeah, so that's basically what I've been listening to. So
right on. Well, this is the section of the show where we would normally plug a email from a listener, but we don't have any this week. If you'd like to email the show, the address is thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. Keep it short and sweet if you can, and we shall read it on the show. If you'd like to hear your own voice on the show, you can send us a voicemail in MP3 format. Same deal, send it to thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. And that leaves us with our last section, which is our Internet Minute, where we share a few quick clips from around the interwebs that we've found interesting. And I have a short thing to share this week. It is a clip of a remote control flying DeLorean. basically, these quadrocopters that are kind of everywhere on the internet these days. Somebody took one and remodeled or built a chassis that looks similar to the DeLorean from Back to the Future, added some LED lights, and the thing hovers around and flies. And it is a really cool little clip. The only unfortunate thing is that it doesn't sound anything like a DeLorean. It sounds like a angry swarm of bees flying around in a park, but it's still cool to look at. I really enjoyed the clip. Peyton, what's on your pick list this week?
I just have two little quick things. One is my wife and I have been thinking about doing some camping this summer with our son, and I ended up coming across this hanging tent from a website called Tensile, TENTSILE.com. And it is a tent that you hang from a couple trees, and then in the bottom you put a stake in the ground, and it sort of keeps the center part of the tent down. So there's a center room, comes in a bunch of different sizes, and the biggest size you can put a double, like a, I think it's a double or a, I think a double sized mattress in the middle, and then there's three little offshoots in there that you can put hammocks. So basically you can have 5 to 8 people sleeping in one of these things. Not terribly practical, but it's pretty cool. And the other thing that I saw online is, Joel and I have been talking ongoing about, you know, these Wacom Cintiqs that are the new ones, the 24 inches and all that fun stuff. But I saw a do-it-yourself Wacom Cintiq kit that a bunch of people they provide it with instructions. And basically you do a mod to a, like a 9 by 12 inch into his 3 or into his 4 or whatever, depending on the model. And it comes with an acrylic kit and stuff, and you just, you know, snap it together. You put a laptop LCD screen over top of it. And anyway, the website's pretty neat. It's called tabletmod.com, and worth checking out if you're handy with that sort of thing. So basically, instead of spending, you know, $2,500 on one, you can build your own for probably under a grand. So
yeah.
Anyway,
is it really that much that little for the cost?
Well, it's $500 for the kit that they send to you, and it comes with all the adapters and everything else you need to do. So there's no soldering or anything involved. It's just snapping stuff together.
Right.
As well as the acrylic case and the LCD screen.
Okay.
And then for another $500, you can buy new,
Intuos 5 or whatever,
yeah. Or you can probably find one cheaper online. So
right.
I say for less than $1,000, you can have yourself a 9x12 Wacom Cintiq,
yeah,
with access to all the buttons and all the other form factors. It's a pretty neat idea. If it comes with videos and all that stuff. But if you're, you know, inclined to, you know, tear apart your hardware, which I'm not really inclined to do,
because either
I haven't had it breaking things and breaking them thoroughly, so I don't know why I'm doing that. And how about you, Matt? What are you seeing out there on the interwebs?
Well, I am a huge fan of Lego. I've got a pretty large Lego collection here myself. It's quite embarrassingly large. but I just love, like, getting away from the computer occasionally and working with my hands, but still being creative. And so, being able to play with Legos is a great way for me to do that and keep from getting too messy with paints or glues or that kind of thing. So there's a blog that kind of daily sort of blogs the best of whatever is new from the Lego builders community. It's called Brothers Brick. You can find it at brothers-brick.com. For me, it's one of those things I can get lost in just kind of scrolling through pages of these images of really great creative and cool stuff that people come up with. And a lot of it's really geeky too, like what's up there right now, some stuff from Ghost in the Shell, and people have been doing a lot. I think there's a radio controlled tank girl tank made completely from Lego elements.
Nice.
And people have been having a lot of fun with the Marvel and DC characters that have been released by Lego recently. So that is one of the things. The other thing is the Chris and Scott and Chris show, which it is Scott Kurtz and
Chris Straub.
Yeah, Chris Straub, and they're both cartoonists who have their own comics, own respective comics, but they're also best friends. And they come together and they produce this show. And I think these are two of the funniest guys on the internet. And I think they're just like waiting to be discovered at this point. And they have a web series, and it's on Penny Arcade TV. If you were to go to Penny Arcade TV, you're able to find their stuff. And it's one of these things where, you know, it's just the two guys getting together, kind of coming up with a script and kind of acting it out and having a really great time doing it, you know. And if you're familiar with them and their personalities, it's a lot of fun to watch these. So that's what I got.
Cool. I really enjoy Chris. I mean, Scott Kurtz, yeah. I find him funny, but sometimes I find him a little bit too much for my tastes. But I found that when he's with Chris, I find that Chris kind of pulls him back just enough.
Yeah.
That Scott then plays off a little bit more of Chris's sense of humor, and it really is a funny take on things. That for me, I don't think I've seen any of the Chris and Scott show, but I've seen their Blamimations.
Yeah, they did
these kind of ad lib, really not crassly animated, but limited animation shorts. And I think Chris is the one that's animating them. And the one that they did about Tron was hilarious.
Yeah,
really, really funny.
Chris Straub is like one of the quickest wits I've seen. I mean, he can come up with something very quickly. One of my favorite podcasts is the Webcomics Weekly podcast. I'm sure you're familiar with that as well.
Yes, very much so. Unfortunately, they don't do it anymore.
No, I still keep it on my iTunes, and I listen through it about once a year, but from beginning to end. But yeah, Chris Straub, he's so quick-witted, and his sense of humor is very much my own, so I really enjoy those.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that is that's it. That's the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to check out all the notes and things that we do with the show, you can visit our blog at thecitadelcafe.com. As I mentioned before, the email is thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. The notes are written by Jocelyn from the Gamers In podcast. We thank Jocelyn very much for the hard work that she puts into the notes. She generally has those up by about Sunday after I post the show on Thursday or Friday. You can find the Gamers In at gamersinpodcast.com. And they usually record live right after we do. So they are probably gone from the chat room and prepping to record their own show right now. If you'd like to check out the Citadel Cafe on any of the social networks out there, it is just our name across everything. The Citadel Cafe will get us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. And before we go, we normally take a moment to thank people for leaving us 5-star iTunes reviews in the iTunes store, but we have none. Tear. So please, if you're listening to the show and you've enjoyed it, then go drop us a line on iTunes. It's one of the best ways for our podcast to reach new listeners. And if you like us, give us a rating, leave us a review, and we might share your thoughts on the next episode right here. I have been Joel Duggan since the day I was born. You can find all of my work on starcrossedonline.com, and you can find me on Twitter and Google+ with just my name, Joel Duggan. Peyton, where can people find you online?
You can find me on my website, cardboardtreehouse.com, on Twitter, at Peyton Francis, P-A-T-O-N, Francis, as well as I have a Facebook fan page, Facebook/cardboardtreehouse and other parts around. So, yeah. And how about yourself, Matt? Where can everybody find you and your good works?
Well, you can read my comic at robotbeach.com. I'm on Twitter at robotbeach. And if you like this show and you want to listen to another geeky podcast that's not quite as well-researched or as as well-produced as this one, you can find me and Adam and our show, Geeks of Steel, at geeksofsteel.com. It's a little blue. Well, it's a lot blue. So if you have small children or if you're a small child yourself, you probably don't want to listen to it. Nice. At least not in front of your parents, right?
Yeah, whatever your mom might listen to on the internet, you may not be safe. Oh, man. Well, you have been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.
Easy and cheap. I like that.
Oh, yeah.
Star 591, I'm not sure who you are, but you're obviously a fan of Chad. And sad to see that he's not here this week, but he shall be back next week.
Chad's got a groupie. I'm telling his wife.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, maybe it is Chad. That's the thing. Without logging
Chad's
in,
his own groupie? That's just sad.
That is sad, yeah.